Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the second talk here in Medientheater. I hope you're well. I would like you to ask to consider becoming a troll. Kitchen needs trolls. The whole venue is run by trolls. And as always, we don't have enough trolls. So I would ask you to consider becoming a troll, which is awesome. Now to the talk. I just learned that Radiosonde is not a Denglish word or a German word used in English contexts. It is an English word. This is the telemetry device that hangs below a weather balloon that goes up into the atmosphere to collect data like temperature, humidity, and all sorts of things. He is Basjo. Yeah, sorry for that. He started getting into the field of radio sounds by collecting them, and ended up being a developer, professional developer for those types of radio sounds. He's talking about the protocol and all the things around. Please welcome Basjo.
Yeah, thank you for the introduction. My name is Johannes, and I will talk about how Radiosonde telemetry works. So I have, as previously heard, a lot to do with Radiosondes. So this year's Radiosonde talk is going to focus more on the in-depth side of the communications engineering, how the telemetry works, and some things we need to know if we want to write our own decoders. So what's on the agenda for today is there will be a short introduction into Radiosondes as well. And if we want to talk about telemetry, then I think it's good to give a little bit of a radio and modulation primer, because I think not all of you have a foundation in communications engineering. Then I want to talk about how it all started and how I got to work with Radiosonde telemetry and ended up doing what I do. Then we will look into two Radiosonde types in particular, the Weisseler RS41 Radiosonde, which is used in Germany, and the Grohe DFM Radiosonde, which is used in the United States and some other territories as well. After we discuss those telemetry formats, then we'll look a little bit more into how we can decode them and how we can say whether our decoder is any good. So a little bit of a disclaimer. Yeah, I work with Radiosondes for a living. No, I'm not speaking on behalf of my employer here, so all that I'm talking about is stuff that I did in my free time, mainly before I joined my current employer, and also some research that I do with my research affiliation. Receiving and decoding Radiosondes might not be legal where you live. Please check your own legislation where you live, and transmission in this band is most certainly not, so please don't transmit on Radiosonde frequencies. Also, these things that I'm going to present here were in large part not discovered by myself. There are a lot more knowledgeable people than me. For example, Xylock 80, which is also known as RS1792, he's very knowledgeable on the topic. Hans, Hansi, Rolf, and a lot of other ones as well. So please pay these guys on the minimum as much respect as you may do me for giving this talk. So a little bit of a Radiosonde primer. So I did a talk on this topic last year as well, so I'm going to keep it fairly short. Radiosondes are the measurement devices which fly aloft weather balloons. So those measurement devices are disposable because you don't know where the weather balloon ends up landing. And they measure something we call PTU data in the industry. That's short for pressure, temperature, and humidity. And also wind data, so how where the balloon is flying and where it is drifting, so how the wind must be in this part of the atmosphere. And sometimes external data from external instruments is collected via a protocol called XData as well. They are very lightweight and battery operated, usually using lithium primary batteries. And they are a backbone to upper troposphere, lower stratosphere weather measurements. So they are heavily used for numeric weather prediction, NWP, and also climatology. There are around 1,000 launch sites that report to the WMO's reporting network, each performing about 1 to 4 launches per day. There are also some special uses, for example, artillery ranges, research applications, and a lot more. There are two large manufacturers, Vaisala and Grohe, on the market, and a few smaller ones as well. So, as I previously said, there are some other radiosonde talks. There is a great talk from Mark Jessop and Michaela Wheeler from the Australian Linux Conference from 2019. And my talk from last year about radiosondes is closely on the same track as this talk, let's say. So choose your own adventure, whether you prefer English or German talks. So, I mean, radiosonde telemetry, it's a very, let's say, niche or obscure topic. I'm glad that so many came here in this early hour and in a foreign language talk to learn about this. But why should I even care, even if I'm into radiosondes and I enjoy hunting radiosondes? I mean, we got those TT-GO boards and I just need to turn it on, tune in the right frequency, and it says everything right here. It's that's a coordinates where I need to go to collect this radiosonde, and why do I need to know how the telemetry format works? And excuse for the German article that I'm going to show here that I read last week when doing the preparations for this talk. It's about some residents in a small German municipality who got a little bit scared of those pesky 5G towers that the T-Mobile wanted to put there, and it had all the, let's say, checkbox marks of such articles, like health risks of 5G are totally unknown. Particularly feared are birth defects in young animals of a nearby farm and children. And I find particularly funny, the protests were initiated by the managing director of a consulting firm that is responsible for implementing digital technology in schools within the county. But ask yourself, like, radiosonde telemetry is a very, very simple topic, but let's put it to 5G. Who of you can explain how 5G works? And who of you has the tools at home to prove that 5G is not some kind of evil wizardry, and that there is some wizard enchanting all the iPhones and some wizard employed at Huawei enchanting all the cell towers? Like, who can prove that? And can you blame people who are not as technically knowledgeable to have a fear of those wizards? And I think that's why we really need to approach this topic on a very basic level. I think radio telemetry is a very basic level. And with this knowledge, we can prove that all those technologies, they are just incremental small changes from technology that's decades old. And if we understand at least a little bit about the basics, then we can make sure that people don't think that this is wizardry, but in fact understand how it is science and how the science work and how they can prove it for themselves with accessible technology. And I want to do a little bit in this regard with this talk as well. So let's talk a little bit about radio and modulation. So why do we need modulation in the first place? It was a great talk about software-defined radio yesterday. I think maybe some of you saw it as well. It's also on the streaming, but unfortunately it's in Germany for the international viewers. And there some reasoning was given with the principle of the superheterodyne receiver. I thought about including this one as well, but I felt against it, and that was a good decision because it was already talked about yesterday. So I want to give a little bit of a different explanation, which is like a fundamental explanation of the principle. So imagine you want to transmit some information wirelessly. It can be some, let's say it's some analog information, maybe some voice signal, maybe just the audio transmission from the wireless microphone or so on. Why don't you just transmit it in the baseband? Just audio is from 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz. Just use these electromagnetic waves. So first problem is the longer the waves, the more difficult to implement the technology gets. Very large wavelengths is only used for some niche applications because it's very difficult to implement. But also think about it. If there's talks going on here and in the other venues as well, and everyone would use this baseband frequency band, then we could only transmit one channel of audio, and we couldn't transmit any more than one signal as far as the signal is propagating. So we need some sort of bringing a signal into a different frequency band. And this is what modulation does. So modulation has two signals, the carrier signal and the signal that we want to use. And that is quite an overused picture that I put here. You can see an analog signal at the top. That is the data that we want to transmit. And there are some two common types of modulation where we use a different wave that's called the carrier. It has the higher frequency that you see here. And we modulate the signal on top of the carrier. So with AM or amplitude modulation, we modulate the amplitude of the signal. So we increase the intensity when we want to transmit higher values, and we decrease it when we want to transmit lower values. And with frequency modulation, we increase the frequency of the signal when we want to transmit higher values and decrease the frequency when we want to transmit lower values. And one thing that you need to understand here is that each frequency with frequency modulation is transmitting a certain amplitude of the signal and not a frequency. So that is something that I confused at least initially. So that's something to keep in the back of your mind. So of course, we're all digital now. So we can look at frequency shift keying as a special case of frequency modulation for binary data. So now we have binary data and we still have our carrier signal, but now we have two distinct frequencies. One is for the lower amplitude, one is for the higher amplitude, and we just switch those two frequencies, and that way we can encode the data. So we can put this into some formulas as well. So we have the frequency deviation, F delta, which is a key component to determine the occupied bandwidth, and it can be expressed as the difference between the two transmit frequencies, so the two frequencies you see in the bottom graph. And you have the carrier frequency, which is the middle frequency. And some important thing to note is that the frequency deviation and the frequency of the symbols, so the individual ones and zeros, is not necessarily constrained in like a hard constraint. So you can choose those two, of course, taking into account some parameters, but you have a modulation index that is the quotient of these two values, and you can choose this modulation index within some certain bounds. Why do I talk about symbols here and not bits? I mean, obviously there are ones and zeros, and this is called bit and not symbol. It's a little bit like with the serial transmissions where you talk about baud rate and not bit rate. So in the simple case of two FSK, where you just have two frequencies, one bit is equal to one symbol because you can only encode one bit with each symbol because you only have two symbols. But with some telemetry we will look at later, that we can only encode half a bit with each symbol. Or otherwise the other way around. We'll look into this a little bit later on. So how did it all get started? Like in 2018, I did my bachelor's thesis on atmospheric measurements, and somewhere I stumbled across those radio sounds. And at the time, I didn't have a Baofeng radio, I think, so I ordered one off eBay or Amazon and tuned into the radio sound channels. I put out my antenna and I heard for the first time those radio sounds. I didn't include it in the presentation, but on SigidWiki there are some example signals that you can listen to. And it sounds a little bit like an old fax machine or analog modulation. And then there's a well-known software toolchain. So of course, radio sound enthusiasts use the RTL-SDR, software-defined radio, as well. And On Windows, the software to go with is SDR Sharp. So you tune into the radio sound frequency with your SDR Sharp, and you get an audio signal. So I said earlier that FSK is just a special case of frequency modulation. So you just use a frequency demodulator in the right bandwidth domain, so 12 kilohertz usually for radio sound signals, and you get out an audio signal. And then you can use a virtual loopback interface to pipe this audio signal back into your machine and connect some sort of software to it. And the software which visualizes radio sound telemetry for RS-41, at least the nicest is RS-41 tracker. So I plugged in my RS-41 tracker, I set up the loopback interface, and right here, all the decoded data. That's so nice. But then I also wanted to hunt down those radio sounds, and initially I found the RS-41 radio sounds, and I took a closer look into them, and I also learned a little bit about the hardware. So I just want to go about this just very briefly. The most interesting part for us here is that we have an STM32 microcontroller and an integrated radio transmitter, a Silab Psi-432. And who joined me with my last talk about hardware reverse engineering knows that step number one is reconnaissance. So I took a look into the data sheet, and I found like some interesting stuff, some not so interesting stuff, some regulatory stuff, but also some interesting information about the transmission. So I found a peak-to-peak deviation 4.8 kilohertz and a data downlink of 4,800 bits per second. So initial guess modulation index will be 1. So that gives the parameters that you can set on your SDR Sharp. So then I thought, I mean, it's audio data, so let's have a look into this audio data. I want to know how we come from this step, where we have some FM demodulated baseband data, to this step. And that's what the first part of this presentation will focus on. So I used everyone's favorite software for engineering or for working with audio signals, made Tentacle proud, and used Audacity. So this is a screenshot that I used for my GitHub repository, where I explain all this stuff, where you can see there are some ones and zeros, obviously, and they are not so pretty, but I guess we can work with them. And if you would listen to the RS-41 telemetry, then you would see that it's about 500 millisecond long frames that are every second, and there's also a short beep in front of every frame. And this is the preamble. So we take a look at where does the data start, and we see a high frequency part of the data here. That's the preamble, and the filter from the FM demodulator needs a little bit of time to settle that there is a signal now. So the nice thing when you have telemetry that starts with a preamble is that you know where you need to start looking for a header and where all the telemetry, the data actually starts. So we can take a look in the data sheet of the transmitter. Maybe we learned something about the protocol that is used there. So this transmitter is actually NRND, so that's where there's the gray text on top of it. We have a preamble, which is not optional. It needs to be between 1 and 512 bytes. We have a sync word, which is also not optional. It needs to be between 1 and 4 bytes. And we have data and everything else. The TX header packet length and TRC is optional. So let's look whether we can find this sync word, and I will refer to this as a header. So behold, we find a header, and we can see this is little endian, and it uses a non-intuitive byte order. So this here is the first nibble, it's a 1, and then we have a 0, then we have a B, then we have 6, C and an A, 1 and a 1. And I was lucky then, because I already know what the correct header should be, because, as I said, some reverse engineering had already been done, but it was not very well documented. So I looked into the code, and I found that out of RS-1729's decoder, this should be a different hex value. But there's a catch here. The whole transmission is XOR scrambled. So there is an XOR mask. I think the XOR mask is fairly static within the transmitter IC. There's a PN9 generator, and you can set an initial value, but there's only a certain number of combinations, so you can get to the XOR mask fairly quickly. But why is there an XOR mask? I mean, does they want to make it a little bit harder for us? Do they don't think that we can figure out how the XOR mask work? No, it's to make sure that there is always, even if there's only a transmission of steady ones or zeros, that there are always enough sign changes in the signal. Because when you consider the signal analog, it needs to have a certain frequency, for example, to pass through some filters, or maybe you want to sync your clock to the clock of the signal, so you want to have a lot of sign changes in the signal, and that's why you scramble with an XOR mask, so then you make sure that even if you have a long stream of ones or zeros, you always get enough sign changes. So one thing that I need to talk about is there are different variants of the RS-41, different telemetry formats. There are three models of RS-41 that are relevant to us. There is the SG variant that does not have a barometric pressure sensor. There is the SGP variant that has a barometric pressure sensor. And there is the SGM variant that has the ability to send encrypted data and also to send data at a later time. So each frame contains two actual data frames. And the conventional RS-41s also have the possibility in X data mode to transmit longer frames as well. There's also the RS-41D model, but it uses a different frequency and it's continuously transmitting, and we don't want to look at this. So once we look at the data that comes after our header, we find something like this. So I wrote our header here as the first four bits, already XOR descrambled, and then we have some sort of protocol structure. So the first 48 bytes in the transmission is actually error correction data. It's the parity part of a Reed-Solomon code. This is an interleaved Reed-Solomon code, so there are two Reed-Solomon code words, and every, I think, second bit or second byte, not sure here, is belonging to a different Reed-Solomon code word, and this is to increase the length of burst errors that this code can correct. After this, there's a single byte that indicates whether this is a long frame, for example, for the encrypted dual frame mode, or for the X-data mode, or whether this is a standard frame. And this is 0F or F0. I suspect this is so even if there's a corruption in one bit, you have still the other bits to indicate which frame length this is, because this is critical to understanding the frame. And then there is a variable amount of, let's say, fields. And each field starts with a unique ID. The first field is 79. Then the length of the field in byte, because fields can have a variable length. Then the data. And at the end, there's a CRC16 checksum. And for a standard RS-41, there are, I think, five fields that we really need to look into, and also just a buffer to fill up some empty space. I don't want to go through all the data that's encoded here individually, but I want to point out some things. So the status field encodes some information on the general status of the radio sound, so you can see the frame number, which is also coinciding with the second since the radio sound was turned on or started the transmission, because there's one frame every second. There's also the serial number, and this is just an 8-character long ASCII string, battery voltage, and there are then some bit fields that indicate in which mode the radio sound is transmitting. Also, there is some more information on, let's say, engineering data. So reference temperatures, or the PWM of the humidity sensor heating, transmit power, and so on. And there's some important thing that I'll come to later. There's also the subframe. Then we have the measurement block. And in the measurement block, the sound sends the actual measurement values, so the pressure, temperature, and humidity. But these don't really look like physical units, and they are not. They are raw ADC values. And like, they are not using the internal ADC of the STM32 here. They're using a completely custom ADC implementation. So these are very raw engineering data. And you can see that there are three values for each measurements. So there is a temperature measurement for the main temperature sensor and for the humidity temperature sensor, but then there are two references, a high, I'm just getting a little bit in front of myself, so it's a high reference and a low reference. And the same is for the capacitive measurements as well, for the humidity and for the pressure. And there's also, thankfully, it's nicely encoded the temperature of the pressure sensor module. And in case you don't have a physical pressure sensor fitted, the pressure is just blank. Also interesting is the GPS info, because radio sound hunters, they want to hunt the radio sound, so they are more interested in the GPS than they are in the PTU values. So we have the GPS time, we have some parameters on the fix, and also some parameters on the satellite that the radio sound is receiving. And quite unusually, a raw GPS data section. So it turns out Vaisala actually has their own differential GPS algorithm, and they need the raw pseudo ranges and Doppler shifts. So I just go a little bit back. You can see like almost a third of the whole frame is taken up by this GPS raw data, all the pseudo ranges and Doppler shifts. But we don't really need that, because in the next field we already also get a nice GPS fix. It's ECEF and not lat long, but a few lines of code will take care of that, and you just need to do a little bit of coordinate transformations and also some accuracy estimates as well. I don't know why I have two of these slides. So what's the information that we want to take out of this? Obviously, like, the GPS fix is the most important information, because we want to find the radio sound. Also, the serial number is for people who want to visualize the radio sounds on nice internet sites like sondihub.org. They want to know the unique serial number, because they don't like it if there are two radio sounds with the same serial, because they will have the same track. So it's very important that if there's a unique serial number somewhere encoded in the transmission, that we find it out. Also, the RS-41 has some timers, a kill timer and a burst timer. So the kill timer activates from the moment that the radio sound is launched, and the burst timer from the moment that the balloon bursts. And after a certain amount of time that is defined within these timers, the radio sound will turn off itself to free the frequency if there's not enough frequencies available. And obviously, if there's a kill timer, then you need to be at the radio sound landing site before the kill timer activates in order to get the signal. Also, like the engineering data, battery voltage, runtime is important as well. But the PTU data, I mean, it's nice to know how warm it is and what the humidity is, but I mean, we are no meteorologists. We just want to get the radio sounds right. And I want to take you on a small tangent here and want to tell you a little bit about the GRUAN project. The GRUAN project is the reference upper air network of the WMO, so the World Meteorological Organization. And it provides the reference data, for example, for research, climatology, and satellite calibration. So very important stuff. And they use radio sounds. They have high requirements for their stations and the radio sound that they will use as well. And they develop something they call GRUAN data products for each instrument they want to use, because they figured out that there's a lot of black box stuff going on with all these meteorological instruments, and time has shown that it's not always good to trust manufacturers, because if they find out that there's a problem with their data, then maybe 20 years of climatology, of data relevant for climatology, is biased, and we don't really know how to correct it. So it's very important that we know how this data is being made. So the GRUAN data product is open source, manufacturer independent, peer reviewed, and provides a measurement error. These are the criteria for a data product to be considered a GRUAN data product. And that sounds quite nice for what we in generally want to do. Like, open source sounds nice, manufacturer independent sounds nice. That's, I mean, fairly close to what we do. But we need to know that this is like the next step after this engineering data. If you know where the sound is in time and space, you don't really know how the wind is there, because there's a pendulum motion effect, and you need to correct for this pendulum motion effect. If you know how warm the temperature sensor on top of the radio sound is, you don't really know how warm the air is in the vicinity of this temperature sensor, because this temperature sensor may be heated up by radiation, or it might be cooled by evaporation if it just passed through a cloud. And you don't really know what the humidity is, because the humidity sensor may experience time lag phenomena where it doesn't change the water vapor within the that is the water that is trapped within the humidity sensor can't escape so quickly as the external ambient values change. So this is really what the Gruan project is after. So they use the physical PTU values that the manufacturer gives them, and then they do this kind of correction with the Gruan criteria. And this is nice for us, because if we have the physical PTU values, then we get for free with the Gruan project basically a high reference open source data product that we can use. And also, I mean, you saw those raw engineering values. I mean, they're not really physical PTU values. And who knows what sort of magic is going on in coming from these ADC values to physical temperature, pressure, and humidity values, and if maybe something could go wrong there, for example, with the calibration data or so on. So that's an external layer of security added to what those guys are doing with Gruan as well. So for the next thing, we need to look a little bit on how Vaisala does their decoding. And they do the physical demodulation and the decoding, just as I showed you as well. And that's the binary telemetry you see on the bottom left. They also use some sort of non-volatile memory data, and this is the NVM data you see on the top left. And then they do the raw PTU calculation, and something drops out of there that's called a raw PTU.xml file. And from that, the data product is calculated and the reports and messages are generated. And Gruan attaches to the center block, so they do their own data product calculation. But they still use the raw PTU values as their input. So if we could show that the raw PTU values that we can get with our open source approach and the decoding we have done so far is as good as the raw PTU values, then we can make a completely open source data product. So if we would implement the RS41 Gruan data product ourselves, I mean, it should be open source, but the documentation is not really yet released, but they're working on it, and we figure out how to calculate the raw PTU values with the same accuracy, then we would have a completely open source RS41 data product. And I mean, that's not something out of the blue. The other radiosondes that are Gruan certified mainly are completely open source. So the Gruan data product uses those engineering values. So that's maybe just something that's special with this sort of radio sound. And luckily, some firmware reverse engineering happened. So in 2019, there was a new EU reverse engineering protection law. In 2022, the readout protection of the STM32F100 was broken. And then some people started to sending me binaries. But I'm not really that proficient with STM32 assembly, so I couldn't help them. But then some TXT files started to go around the interwebs. And it turned out that the sond calculates the PTU values internally as well. And if you think about it, that makes sense, because the sond has a heated humidity sensor, and in order to know how much the humidity sensor needs to be heated, the sond needs to know the physical values as well. And there's a hidden service menu, and there's a hidden UART machine-to-machine interface. Just a little bit more on that one later, sorry. But first we need to look a little bit into the second block, that's the NVM transmission. So when you are a legitimate user of the radio sond, you have an NFC readout device, and it reads out the non-volatile memory data directly out of the radio sond. But it turns out, and also the non-volatile memory contains all the configuration, calibration data, and status variables. So all the other stuff that we're interested on that's not really part of the telemetry itself. It's 800 bytes long, and it turns out the sond transmits it as the subframe over 50 individual frames. So we just need to collect 50 consecutive radio sond frames, and then we got the NVM data ourselves, luckily. And there's a lot of stuff in here. A lot of engineering stuff, but also here the calibration values, humidity matrix calibration values, and so on, that we need to know to make use of the discovered algorithms. Also just a little bit about the service menu. You can do a lot of stuff in here. and it's really nice. That's all I'm going to say about it for now. But just make sure that, I mean, you can change the registers of the transmission chip using the service menu. But obviously, if you turn on the radio sound, use those registers to change the transmission of the sound to the amateur frequency band. It's not a good idea to start the radio sound like this, because if it resets, then it will be back to the original frequency. And you don't want that, so don't do that, please. Also, there's one patent that helps as well, because it has some formula that is important for the humidity calculation as well in it. But this also means that our initial plan to make a completely open source decoding toolchain is now gone, because this formula is patented. So we know it, but we can't use it. Don't know whether that really helps, but it's nice to have, I guess, the formula. So if we use those formulas and this data, we still have the question, is that PTU data any good? So can we use it? And that's what I looked into a little bit more detail while I was doing research at my university. So we did a conference paper on that. And it turns out that in generally, yeah, the temperature values, they are really close. So we're just like, you have here a histogram that shows the number of occurrences in, or the number of data points in a data set that consisted, I think, about 20 radio sound launches from a German institution. That thankfully shared their data with us, and it's really close, so it's just like 50 millikelvins low. And I just put the data sheet values here, the combined uncertainty and sounding here, just as a reference. So, the first one on top is the pressure. It's just about 0.05 hectopascals, so I don't want to transform that in pascals right now, but the pressure is spec'd to 1 hectopascals and we're well below that. The temperature is spec'd to 0.4 Kelvin, and I think we're within like 50 millikelvins here. And the humidity is spec'd at around 4% RH, and if we use this this patented formula, then we find that we are generally, with a lot of values, we are pretty close, but we have some outliers that are up to 2% difference. So that would add like half of the manufacturer specified uncertainty on top of that, and that's not really something that we want to have. So the humidity, it still needs a little bit of work, but in general you can show that the raw PTU data that we get out of the Weisseler approach is the same that we can get with our own formulas. Yeah, and that's basically the first part about RS41 telemetry. Now we want to look into raw DFM telemetry. And to do that, we need to go back to the 1980s, when radio sound still looked something like this. This is the Weisseler RS80 radio sound. It's the predecessor of the current radio sound, I think. And it did not use any of this. It has a completely analog transmission. So how those kind of radio sounds worked is that you had one transmitter, an analog transmitter, and you still had some sort of a data converter. So you had an oscillator where the frequency determining element was the measurement element. So the frequency of this transmitter changed according to the physical values. And then you used this analog frequency to modulate the transmitter. So you really got an analog frequency modulated on the transmission frequency that was respective of the data that you wanted to transmit. And of course you only have one transmitter, but you have a lot of sensors that you want to transmit, so you use a digital switch to just turn around those. If you see some really old pictures of radio sounds, they sometimes have like a little spinning wheel that's driven by wind. That's an analog switch. So as this wheel spins, and while the radio sound flies, it switches the different capacitors or resistors in circuit with the transmitter, so you can construct this electromechanically as well. And the DFM telemetry, or the DFM radio sound format, the first DFM radio sound was the DFM-90 in 1990. It was the first completely digital radio sound. So it had an ADC, it digitized all the values, and it sends out digital frames. But it still closely resembles how the telemetry of those old radio sounds worked. So you still have comparatively short frames, only 224 milliseconds long, and each frame only consists of the sensor data of a single frame. of a single sensor, sorry. So that's quite different to what we saw with the RS41, which used 1 second frames. Also just how looks the DFM17 from the inside? That's just a picture from the internet I took. And you can see it's basically identical. So it has an STM32 microcontroller as well. It has a pretty similar Scilabs chip. And it's interesting that this Scilab chip really is the best fit for RadioSonde. So I think more than half of all the RadioSondes you can buy use one of those two Scilabs transmitter chips. You can also compare the telemetry information. So you can see that the complete measurement cycle is 4 times 224 milliseconds, so 896 milliseconds for the TU data for the DFM17. And of course, the GPS fix comes every 1 second, so it's 1 second for the wind. Frequency range is the same, modulation is the same. GRAW has an advantage here because they only have a baud rate of 2,500 baud, but use a similar frequency deviation, so you got a higher modulation index, and that generally helps with decoding the RadioSonde data. But with the lower baud rate comes a lower bit rate, and GRAW uses a Manchester decoding or a two-state phase shift keying as a line coding here as well. So the bit rate is only half of that, 1250 bits per second. Frame size of a single frame is only 35 bytes. And GRAW uses a different sort of error correction that is not as efficient. So the data rate is generally much lower, but on the opposite, DFM data is much easier to receive than RS41 data because of all the higher margins that you have here. DFM decoding workflow, I have some nicer pictures of that because that's already also part of my master's thesis, so I prepared some nice pictures for that one as well that I can recycle here. You have the raw FSK demodulated data, so a baseband stream just as we had with the DFM as well, the RS41 as well. And you this consists of 560 half symbols. Because you have the Manchester line code, every two following half symbols are decoded as one symbol. So then you do the Manchester decoding, two half symbols gives you one bit, and then you have 560 divided by 2 bits, and then you can make bytes out of these. And you got some really nice even numbers here. You got a 2-byte header, 7 bytes for the sensor, and that's like what I said to you earlier, like just the sensor that's switched between those frames. But at some later stage, like GPS was invented, and there was still some space in these frames that was previously not used because the old microcontrollers couldn't transmit and measure at the same time. So there was just like a bunch of, I don't know really zeros or ones sent during this time. So you still have 26 bytes that you can use for data or GPS values in here. Then there's a step for the interleaving and error correction. It's only a Hamming code used here, so to be able to still have some amount of burst errors that you can correct, there's interleaving going on. So that way, I think it's 13 bits burst errors for the data fields. Not really sure. It's in the documentation, in the open source documentation. And from this intermediate form, then you can construct a data frame. And this is really what we are looking into in a little bit. So from the 7-byte sensor values, you make a 3-byte sensor field and 1 nibble for a sensor ID, because you want to know which sensor is being transmitted. And for the data fields, you from the 13 bytes, you make 6 data bytes and 1 nibble for the ID. But the ID is in the back, not in the front. And when you accumulate enough frames, like 4 frames for the PTU data set, plus some more frames for the alternating fields, and 7 or 8 data fields for the GNSS data, then you get a complete PTU plus GNSS data set. So after the last step, when we have those data frames decoded, how does it look like? I think it's very abstract at this point. So let's just look at a snippet of data at this point. So every frame consists of a sensor field and 2 data fields. And with the sensor field, you need to look in the first nibble to see the ID. So you have sensor ID 0, 1, 2, 3, 0, 1, 2, 4, 0, 1, 2, 5, 0, 1, 2, 6. So the fourth sensor field is an alternating sensor field where there's alternating values being sent. And for the data fields, you look at the last nibble. So this is ID 6, 7, 8, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and so on. But because 224 does not share a common denominator with a 1 second interval, sometimes you have 7 data fields, sometimes you have 8, and in case there's no data available, you also sometimes have an empty data field. So by accumulating enough of these data, you can construct a whole telemetry frame. So what do these sensors actually mean? Like you have a value for temperature, humidity, temperature, and then some sort of configuration. So this is just an exemplary sensor configuration. The general type of telemetry stayed the same all the way since the 90s, and so there's a lot of different configurations of the different sensors. And you can do the same for the data configuration as well. And this is all stuff that is on GitHub in the relevant decoders as well. So just one thing that comes up a lot with DFM radio sound telemetry that I want to mention as well. As far as the telemetry concerned, DFM radio sound serials still follow the same coding of the serial year, and then an ongoing number as it was previously. But now the product serial additionally features the date of manufacture. Also, there is no encoding of the radio sound type within the telemetry. So you saw earlier for the RS-41 in the subframe, there was a clear identification in ASCII what sort of RS-41 it is. This is not the case with the DFM radio sound. So there are some hints. There's the polarity of the signal because different generations of radio sound use a different polarity. There's also the sensor configuration, so the number of alternating or fixed sensors. And there's the data structure within the sensors. So does it look like an INT16? Does it look like ASCII, basically? Most importantly, it should be taken into account where the radio sound launched from. So if you found a radio sound of a particular type from a certain station, and you now have a radio sound in the air that has the same telemetry format, then it's likely that it will be the same radio sound. But if you just see on Sondi Hub that it is identified as a DFM09, maybe doesn't necessarily say that it's a DFM09. It may be a different type of radio sound because there is some guessing going on with the decoders, but there's no way to say for sure with this protocol. So now I just want to use the last few minutes to talk a little bit about baseband decoders. So what I showed you at the beginning, the Audacity data, so just the FMD modulated baseband stream, how can you decode it? And a little bit of a disclaimer, we will only take a look at analog baseband data as an input, which is already FMD modulated. Direct, so IQ, FSK demodulation can have some advantages, but they are mostly not about what radio sound amateurs or radio sound hunters care about the sensitivity, but more like frequency stability and so on. In regards to sensitivity, you can like get a little bit more out of it, but not that much. Getting the highest decoder sensitivity is not always the prime objective, and it's a starting point because like in the 1980s and 90s, this was all you had. You had your demodulation output on your analog radio, and you could put this into a sound card on a PC and work with it. So that's what I did for my master's thesis. Previously, we had a decoder architecture that was based on a modified Costas loop. So it did a full clock recovery. And once the clock was recovered, then it did an integrate and dump on the passband filtered data, and then you don't know which Manchester polarity you get, so you need to look into both variants. So you don't know where your Manchester symbol starts, if you're in the middle or if you're in the start of the Manchester symbol. So you need to decode change chains from this point on. And you just add up the Manchester symbols, and if that way you can see if you got a valid Manchester symbol or not. And then you can correlate like literally with the literal header OX45CF to see whether you found a frame or not. And depending on whether you got the right or the wrong Manchester polarity, not polarity, like the part where you are in the Manchester symbol, the even or the odd decoder will output the right data. And that was quite problematic because this is a really an analog implementation that's brought into the digital domain. And we worked a little bit with the Radiosonde community, and we made this much more similar to what amateur decoders already used. So the new decoder architecture just uses a low-pass filter at first, and we just use the sample rate of the signal to calculate two masks, the header mask and the symbol mask. And then we just do a continuous cross-correlation of the mask that we calculated previously and do a peak detection on it. And in case we found the header, then there will be a strong signal with the peak detection, and then we found basically the signal. This works, of course, best if there's long headers, because if you have long headers, then you have a stronger correlation between the header and the data. So that sort of architecture is really targeted to longer headers. So yeah, that's a little bit of a problem, but you can throw more calculating power at it, and then it's no big deal. And then you can do use the symbol mask and do another cross-correlation that you just evaluate at the peak points you already know and quantize that, and then you have your detected frames. So where you previously could only do the correlation at just the numeric phase, where you just correlate two binary numbers, you can now, due to the computing power, computer power increase and so on, you can do a correlation in the stream as well. And that way you don't need any clock recovery, because you say, like, my transmitter clock, it's stable enough that during the duration of a frame it will not drift more than, let's say, a tenth of a symbol away. That's of course the thing that needs to be there, but we now have those digital transmitters, digital receivers, and they are fairly good at it. So what can we make out of this? DSP-SV module here in this graph is the decoder that was previously in use. I implemented the principle myself and already got a little bit of a improvement. And the header correlation decoder is the decoder I showed you last. So what you see here is the signal-to-noise ratio of a baseband signal, a generated baseband signal, and gross packet error rate. That means you have two steps that you need to consider here. First, you have the packet detection. So is the header recognized with this method? But then if the header is recognized, you may not have sufficient energy in the bits to be able to decode the field. So you may have some bit errors as well. So my metric of gross PER takes into account the frames that are unusable because they were missed, or that are unusable because they got too many bit errors. And you can see that there's almost a 3 dB improvement between those decoders and the bit error rate as well, because you don't have this clock recovery step that adds additional clock jitter in the recovery, but you're looking at the limits between the bits directly, and the bit clock is usually more stable than the recovered bit clock. Also, the folks over at Radiosonde AutoRx, they did some comparison beyond Radiosondes, and this is using two different sorts of demodulation types. So there's an FSK demodulator that was written specifically for this purpose, but it's just a 2FSK demodulator. And there's also the approach that I just showed you. So there's using RTL-FM as an FM demodulator and then piping this output signal into the baseband decoder, just like I did. And generally, for most of the radio sound type, now they use the FSK demodulator because, as I said, it has advantages when you have frequency offsets. There's also a comparison between the FSK and FM demodulators, but it requires a little bit more in-depth analysis, so I don't put it here. You can look it up yourself. It's all on GitHub. So you can see that the required bit energy per noise for 50% packet error rate is much lower with the DFM radio sound than with the RS-41 radio sound, and that's due to all the overhead in the protocol that I showed you earlier. Also, just as prior to last slide, comparing different testing methods. So what I did here was I used simulated baseband data with variable signal-to-noise ratio. And that's good if you're comparing one decoder to another and just looking at the algorithmic implementation. Then there's also the variant of using simulated or complex baseband data with a variable EB over N0. And this is good if you're comparing one transmission scheme to another, because EB over N0 is basically the variant of comparing different bandwidth requirements from different modulation schemes. But both of these don't account for the actual radio receiver and its problems. So if you want to take a look into the whole receiving chain, then you still need to take a look into your whole receiving chain. And what I found is that it's usually best to do the real testing, pipe real analog data or real data through the decoder and the whole decoding chain and look how it performs. And this also takes into account all the non-linearities into the receivers and all the different testing scenarios that you might have. So what I found is that if you really have a well-defined test case, then the generated data is good, but it can't replace real-life data, which is unfortunately much harder to get. Also, all I said here is published on GitHub or published in the literature as well. And if you have any questions, then don't hesitate to contact me. I think we have time for a little bit of questions.
Thank you very much. This was super interesting. We have 4 minutes. Someone a question?
Hi, good morning. Many thanks for the interesting talk. What is your take? Do you expect to be radio sound data to be encrypted in the future, or will the amateur still be able to receive it and decode it? What do you think?
That's a hard one to answer. I think within the meteorological community, like generally, radio sound hunters have a well-received image, but of course that depends on how we all as a community behave. And I can't stress that enough. Like, there are a lot of nice people out there, but there are also some people out there who are maybe not so nice. So you need to take that into account. On the side of the manufacturers, it's difficult to take a look at how let's say the requirements will be there, but I think with the environmental concerns as well, there is a need that radio sounds need to be collected. But that's something you also need to look at. Weissala did a talk at last year's TECO about the environmental impact of radio sounds, and they did an analysis that found that the total life cycle CO2 emission of a complete radio sound launch is like, I think, equivalent of 30 or 40 kilometer car drive. You have to maybe take these numbers with a little bit of grain of salt, as those CO2 equivalents always are, but that's like, if we are recovering radio sounds and we're driving more than 40 kilometers, are we really doing a good job there? So in this field, I think there will be a little bit, or there will be some movement, and it's hard to give a good estimate on how things will go on.
Well, just 1 minute left. Thank you very much. I hope you learned something and you had a good time. Yeah, enjoy day 3 of GPN. Consider becoming a troll. The venue needs you. Thank you very much.